I'm very pleased to welcome Fremantle Shipping News' Fiona Stanley. Welcome, Fiona.
Thank you very much, Michael. Very nice to be here, as they say.
We're in the west end of Fremantle, a lovely part of the world.
Yes.
And Fiona, last Friday night, we were not far from here, at Cadogo Art House at Bathers Beach, one of the earliest European settlement sites in Western Australia, but long the country of the Whadjuk Noongar people. And the occasion was the launch of a book going under the name of Health, Spirit, Country and Culture, which is part of a series.
Yes, it's a series of, you left out the most important bit of the title, which is First Knowledges.
Yes.
First Knowledges, Health, Spirit, Country, Culture. And it's a part of a series that's been done for the National Museum of Australia. And the overarching editor is Margot Noah Neal, who works at the Australian Museum. And we were number 8 in the series.
I'll just mention the other ones
because they're interesting.
They're fantastic. And I know people will have actually already read and know about some of them, if not all of them. The titles in the First Knowledges series are Songlines, Design, Country, Astronomy, Plants, Law, Innovation. Coming up next year, Ceremony, but right now, Health. And it's Shawana Andrews, Sandra Eads, and you are the authors of this 2024, as I say, just launched.
Just published book, yes. I want to just say a little bit about the series.
Please.
The idea of this series, which nobody thought was going to be terrifically exciting, was that you would get an Aboriginal expert and a non-Aboriginal expert in the particular field of endeavour or interest, and they would look at the First Knowledges and say, well, how are First Knowledges relevant for today's world? And they have been incredibly successful. And I think because of the increasing interest around the disastrous referendum and other things, the Uluru Statement from the Heart and so on, there's been a huge interest, increasing interest in using Aboriginal knowledges. And of course, the one on country, which is written by Bill Gammage and Bruce Pascoe, a very good combination of two experts, is about country, but it's also about fire and land management and all the things that now people are becoming extremely interested in, because they are in fact better ways of managing country than we have totally screwed it up. But the one that I really was unusually delighted at, I don't know if any of the people who are listening have seen the Seven Sisters exhibition, but Carly Noon and Crystal De Napoli did one on astronomy. They're both Aboriginal. There isn't a non-Aboriginal astronomist in this. And they're both, you know, astrophysicists. And they both had terrible childhoods. I mean, how do these guys manage not only to survive the history of genocide, rather damaging childhoods, and then turn out to be astrophysicists? I mean, it's absolutely brilliant. Anyway, I loved that one, but all the others are very interesting. Design is fascinating. You have no idea how sophisticated Aboriginal design is and was.
Well,
yeah. Anyway, and people are using it.
Just take a boomerang. The engineering behind it.
Yeah, absolutely.
The aerodynamics of it.
Yeah. So, and I have to say just quickly that this was a salve for us, because we wrote it during the 2023 campaign, which we could see was going, you know, pear-shaped and horrible. And I could disappear into my study and talk to Shawana and Sandy and say, I'm going to do this now and write something which was obviously the best evidence for the voice that ever was written. But anyway, there you are.
What I love, going through the whole of the book, there's so much to pick up, including, I should say, the foreword or the preface by Margot Noah Neal, the series editor.
Yes.
I mean, she makes the point at the end of that, where, and I'll just read it, she says, while it is well known that colonialism has had an enormous impact on Indigenous societies, this series reveals the other side of that coin, the significant influences that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures are having on Australian society and history, and the enormous contribution our people are making, which mainstream Australia is beginning to embrace. And it's absolutely true for me, although it's a relatively recent phenomenon. You think about Aboriginal art,
but
then you think about all of these topics.
Yes.
When I first started acting for Aboriginal people making native title claims. I can remember
we
were out on country at night and the stars and the stories and the old men who could just tell you these stories. Some of them were very deep and probably shouldn't have been talked about. Others were others were shared, and of course the Seven Sisters were, were there.
Brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
And you discover this other culture about which you know nothing.
You need to read astronomy. And the other quick thing to say is that they did a big survey of Aboriginal vision, Aboriginal eye disease, done by Hugh Taylor at University of Melbourne. And he got amazing results. From some young people out at Warman, for example, Turkey Creek, had the best vision that he'd ever seen, and they didn't need a telescope to look at that, those stars. It was extraordinary. But you can see how what a genetic advantage that would be if you need to look far on the land, to look for game and look for other things. Anyway, well, just to add to Margot's point about the fact that these knowledges are now becoming so important and interesting is the thing that kept on recurring to me through the whole book was how, with the genocide that was so profound and so ghastly, how did these knowledges survive? And they're mostly orally transmitted. I mean, there's a bit of museum and anthropology stuff. Anthropologists were not very good for Aboriginal people. They exploited them and researched them to death. But they didn't actually have outcomes that improved Aboriginal circumstances. Some did, and we mentioned some of them. But on the whole, this is oral transmission. And I was talking to one of my lovely Aboriginal researchers who's done a PhD with us, Robin Williams, who's working with Sandra now. And I said, you know, Robin, how did it happen? She said, the grandmothers went underground. Now, she was at Moore River, the Moore River settlement. Her, her mother was at Moore River. And somehow those grandmothers must have known that this colonisation, this genocide was going to be very profound. So they went underground with their knowledge. Isn't that interesting? I don't know how they did that.
It's
extraordinary how much they know.
I know it is. The thing that I discovered rather quickly in the work that I became involved in was just how important the women were. The men sort of portray that they're running everything, but the women and the women's law.
And it's very interesting because when I look back on my career nearly, you know, in the 1970s, I started working in Aboriginal health. Most of the people, there were some outstanding blokes, but on the whole, most of the people who were pioneering things like the Aboriginal services and Aboriginal training and so on were women, like Joan Winch, who's one of the most outstanding Aboriginal West Australians. She started Marmuditch, which is the Aboriginal Health Worker Training College. It was the first one in the world. You know, she got the sort of Nobel Prize for Public Health from the WHO for that. You know, an unsung heroine. Yeah. But it was the women, and they were, and they still are, like June Oscar, like Anne Polina. You know, they are terrific. But of course, there are outstanding men as well, but there you are. Yeah, no, I agree with you.
And it's little things too that I discovered. You turn up and you've got a bit of a runny nose, and this lovely lady who made me her son at one point said, "What have you got there?" And off they go and rustle up some leaves, boil it up in water, and say, "This will fix you up." Oh. And it's just part of life.
Well, we refer to Vivian Hansen in here, and of course Sandra has a whole chapter on. We don't cover medicines. Because how could you?
Well, go forever.
Every area of Australia has a different. And also there's intellectual property involved. We didn't want to do that. So this isn't about medicines. It's about health and well-being. And so we mentioned Vivian Hansen, who with John, I can't remember now, but he, John Horsfall, have published these two incredibly successful books on Noongar bush foods and Noongar medicines. And she gave me the most wonderful cream for my little granddaughter's eczema. And I saw Viv the other day, on Saturday, and she said, "How's your little grandchild's eczema?" And, you know, so the knowledge is there. Yeah. And Noel Nanup is like an encyclopedia.
Well, it's all part, is the point you make in the book, is of a holistic way of approaching the world. I mean, at the very end of the last chapter, that last chapter in your book, which is headed Planetary Health, Ancient Wisdom and Modern Problems, which I think the three of you are the authors of.
Yes, yes.
Whereas in some cases you've each individually written. Yes. You say the book describes the powerful and effective Indigenous knowledges for health and for well-being. It explores Aboriginal ways of knowing, being and doing that are ancient and sophisticated. They do not need modernising, but their applicability requires nuanced and respectful management so they can be of benefit not just to Aboriginal people, but for all of us. We feel strongly that, and you quote a source, reweaving Australia's ecological map needs to be reconsidered not just for health services, but for all ways of living in this country. And that's the end of that quote. And, and that's a powerful concept. Tell us how you weave traditional knowledges in health, using that as a narrower rubric.
And I get goosebumps when you're reading it. It's ridiculous, isn't it? I just quote you another bit from that, and it'll summarise it. When Norman Swan interviewed Fiona and Donna Archie about the voice to Parliament being a health issue, this is also from the last chapter, he asked Donna to Donna Archie is the head of Congress in Alice Springs. She runs the Aboriginal Medical Service in Alice Springs. He asked Donna to describe for the listeners what an Aboriginal community-controlled health service was. Donna runs the Central Aboriginal Congress, one of the largest and most successful Aboriginal community-controlled organisations in Australia. As she described Congress in Alice Springs, with its holistic approaches and focus on families, Norman commented, well, that's a health service we'd all like to have. That's the point of this book. And why I guess I loved writing that planetary chapter best, but then Sandra and Joanna stood up for me against the publishers because I had a bit of a rant about Margaret Thatcher and extreme capitalism. But it's all true. That's why we've got the planet we have, is because of the exploitation for greed and extreme wealth. But the other chapter that illustrates this very well, really well, I think, is the Birthing on Country, Dying on Country chapter, which...
That really took my breath away.
Oh, it is so exciting.
Some people would say, if they're non-Indigenous, why would you want to, not be born in a hospital? Why would you not want to...
It's so safe, isn't it, Michael? So safe. Give me a... Anyway, so what's so wonderful about this and why I felt so confident in writing this chapter about the birthing, of course, I've been researching that for a long time, but I'm particularly now involved with Rhonda Marriott, who launched our book on Friday night, who is an outstanding professor at Murdoch and runs Nankira Institute for Change. And the whole thing that she's been involved in is looking at Aboriginal ways of birthing and how they can be implied to improve the outcomes for Aboriginal women. However, when you look at this, we had a wonderful symposium and there were about 250 women, Aboriginal women, midwives, doctors, social workers, psychologists from all over Australia, with example after example of bringing back grandmother's way of birthing. But of course you can't go and say, I'm just going to get, when I know I'm pregnant, I'll just go and get my Aboriginal grandmother and my mother and will look after me in pregnancy and love me and stroke me, and then under the birthing tree we'll have the baby and smoke it in the fire and, we'll live in a tribal group that never lets that child's feet touch the ground for the first 2 years because it's loved and nurtured.
And we'll deal with the placenta too.
We'll deal with the placenta. I'll come back to that. But, so you can't do that. Aboriginal women have all the diseases of colonisation. They've got diabetes and rheumatic heart disease and STDs and high blood pressure and they've got mental health disorders and they're often drug addicts and so on. So what have these Aboriginal women done with all these services all over the country? They've married them with the best of Western medicine to diagnose and to treat all of these Western diseases. But Aboriginal women have never trusted the mainstream. For absolutely the correct reasons. They're treated like dirt by our white obstetric services. Really, it's been appalling. The stories that have come out of Rhonda's work and everyone else's work, I quote some of them in the book. It's awful. And of course, there's this thing about having to go from country to a major centre for delivery so that the white obstetric services can give you the best outcome for your baby, and then they treat you like shit. Many women abscond from that. Many women who were transferred into Derby, for example, or down to Perth, tried to run away. And they're young women. They're leaving their family and all their support behind. And their outcomes weren't any better. But what's so fantastic with these new Aboriginal women-run services, many of them are inside an Aboriginal-controlled community health service, but the Koori Maternity Service, which has been around for 20 years in Victoria, it's in three major hospitals now. But the reason why it works is Aboriginal women trust the services because they are tailor-made and culturally kind and empathetic and so wonderful.
People sometimes don't know what self-determination means.
This is why, and there's been trials. These women, Yvette Rowe and Sue Kildea, work in the Northern Territory, and they're the ones who've championed a lot of this, but they've actually done really rigorous evaluation. Not only are there better outcomes, not only do women attend
yes.
and get their antenatal assessments and everything, they attend, whereas yeah. in white services they don't. But it halved the preterm birth rate. It reduced infant mortality. And the most amazing thing, with the latest data, it halves the number of children going into care, being taken from their families. So what does that say? Michael, that's about spirituality and support and culture being strong for you. It's fantastic. There's no excuse now. This is the way to go. So not only have we colonised Aboriginal birthing, but white male obstetricians on the whole have colonised pregnancy and childbirth so they can make money out of it.
You're not thinking of C-sections, are you?
I am. And we've done so much research on this, not just in Aboriginal health, but in the whole population. Mm. And let me tell you that the increase in caesarean sections in Western Australia anyway, I'm sure it's similar everywhere in the world, is in young women having their first birth with no clinical indications and private health insurance. And so, give me the power and I will deliver you the perfect baby. Well, they'll never can do that. But it's just been so, and now of course what's happening is that white women in Australia are having reviews done on them for the birth trauma that they're experiencing from this system, which does not concentrate on the family, the mother. All it concentrates is on getting a live baby so you won't be sued.
So
Sorry to be so critical, but it's absolutely the truth. And if you put in these empathetic services, all these rates fall.
So that's where Indigenous knowledge is then kick in again.
Exactly.
And you can look
can
at
you
your data.
Can you see why I'm so excited?
I can.
So that women are now saying, gosh, I want a doula. I want to have someone looking after me in my pregnancy. I want a midwife delivery. I don't want to have, electronic field monitoring, an epidural, induction of labour, caesarean section. I can't lift up my baby because I've got a scar in my tummy. Most of them, there are emergency C-sections and they have saved babies. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that the increase in these interventions have not been women-centred or family-centred, and they have been incredibly damaging for many women.
Then there's, in a sense, well, in every sense, the other side of the coin, the end of life, dying
yes.
on country, and Sandra Eads discusses her own mother.
Oh, it's a beautiful story.
Yes.
It's a beautiful story.
And we can all understand, in a very simple sense, a desire to die at home. It's increasingly challenging, but for Aboriginal people who've had a lifestyle from the beginning to the end,
yes.
more traditional than we
used. Well, this is why it's so fascinating for me, because, you'd imagine that if you actually live in Yolngu country in Arnhem Land, or you live in the central desert of Australia, then you have a very strong connection to land, and of course you want to be, you want to die on country. But let me tell you that all of the Aboriginal people that I talk to about this live in the city. They're second or third generation in the city, and they want to also die on country. And if they can't, as Millie Penny said to me, we bring some soil up from country.
I love that story.
You come in with it. But
yes.
what is being clear now is that there's a wonderful program in the Northern Territory called Purple Heart. They have 18 remote clinics and they now have a bus. Their outcomes, they want to have palliative care, renal dialysis, all these things out on country. And they have the best, this is what I mean, they have the best outcomes of any dialysis service in the country. So The cost effectiveness is so clear, apart from the fact that it's just more humane. And those stories were so beautiful for me, and the rituals around them are still evident in the metropolitan areas. It's very powerful, that spiritual connection. I just found it gorgeous. I just want to mention one more thing in this chapter, because I wanted to come back, about the placenta garden.
Please. It's one of the first things I learned about in the native title work I did, because in more traditional settings like the Pilbara and
yes,
the Kimberleys, where I did a lot of work, I suddenly became aware of it. And the things I didn't know.
Oh, same here.
It's amazing.
Same here. Well, this placenta garden was presented at the conference and I just wept. It was so beautiful. So even if you don't give birth on country, you can plant your placenta on country. And there's a beautiful, the Wathaurong community near Geelong in Victoria have created a placenta garden. And it's a very women's business, closed area. The women from Bunnings came and did all the garden. It's locked, but their initial planting of placentas, women want, they froze their placentas ready for the planting, but the garden wasn't quite ready. So the first, 2011, I think, was the first planting. They had 40 placentas that they put in. Now you can imagine, what if your baby dies? What if your baby is taken away? And you can go to this placenta garden so that Mother Earth knows that your baby was born, didn't necessarily be born on that country, but the placenta is born in that country. So Mother Earth knows about that spirit child. And so it's actually become a place for healing and grieving, as well as for nurturing. So at the end of the chapter on, you know, birthing and dying on country, I wrote this. And it's, I mean, fast, far crying, you'll have
I'll
to give
the hand
me a
here.
Tissue. As a non-Indigenous person, I have found that obtaining the information for this chapter was quite riveting. The birthing symposium was one of the best meetings I've ever attended. And the more I read and interviewed people about birthing and dying, the more I realised how powerful, nurturing and caring these practices are. I would have loved to have birthed my two daughters with a doula and in a beautiful environment, to have buried their placentas in a special place that we could then have visited to heal and manage the spiritual aspects of our lives. I would not like to die in a large and busy hospital with people who are trying to keep me alive against all odds. I would prefer to be at home with my family and die more naturally. For me, the message is that both birthing and dying are part of our circle of life. They are not really medical conditions. We should look closely at these traditional Indigenous knowledges and take from them those aspects that would make our lives and life events so much more meaningful. So the point we're making in the book is not only is this better for Aboriginal people, but there are lessons here for the problems that we're now facing in our own health service. And I just think that's, I get so excited about this. You know, this could be the way forward for the most cost-effective, humane and satisfying health and well-being services that we've ever had. Am I too idealistic and naive, maybe?
Well, I immediately think of all of the health boffins, Fiona, who you'll know much better than I, but I know a couple of them, and health ministers and people who get together, and health education, general welfare, just absorbs, sponges up all of the public revenue. And they'll be saying, well, it's all well and good for Fiona to write that. I'm glad she had a good time at that conference. But if we do these things and we extrapolate from the Indigenous knowledges and start to co-design with the Aboriginal people,
that's
these
the word,
systems,
co-design.
What's it going to cost? Are you going to blow the budgets out or are you going to do something different?
Oh, you see, that's such a good question, because it is the question about, you know, what do we do? Now, the problem with our publicly funded health services, which is focused mostly on end problems, end stage problems. So it's all hospitals, it's acute care, it's, you know. So the budget for prevention is pathetic in Australia. We're so good at it. Look at us with COVID, and look at vaccination, and look at, you know, road traffic accidents, look at smoking until vaping, don't start me, until vaping, those cigarette companies are absolutely vile. And, you know, so we need to have this balance, which is, let's create the environments which are healthy to prevent disease. I mean, if you want to actually, I've just given a talk on climate change and child health to the WA Health Department, and I said, look, if you want to actually reduce your costs, focus on prevention, because the way that you're producing all these carbon emissions and some plastics and stuff is because people are getting sick. And yet what you need to do is get out there and ensure that they are healthy. So that expenditure needs to change. And of course, the cost effectiveness of that is that you will reduce hospital costs, which are huge and burgeoning out. And of course, the reason, another reason why the health system is so challenging and costly and increasing in cost is not just because of the aging population. And it's not just because, you know, it is because doctors charge. The fee for service is a very, very negative thing for the health service. So I think we need to go and,
Fiona, there's all a health cost side.
Mm-hmm.
I then bring you straight back to your book.
Yes.
Because what do you want the readers, and which readers, yes, to take what? Yes. From yes. what you and well, your co-authors produced.
Yes, well, I mean, what we are saying is that please understand that Aboriginal health and well-being and the knowledges about that are sophisticated and relevant for today. They are relevant for today, and not just to improve Aboriginal health services, but to improve health services for everybody. And so that if there could be, and some of the doctors I've spoken to who work in hospitals are very excited about the concepts. There's a lot of people who do want to change the way our health system is run. It's very racist. It's very focused on end of life. It's not focused on, well, you know, I mean, it's not focused on prevention. So we need a bit of a revolution, and maybe this book, along with others, will start to stimulate at least thinking about that. So I would love to see we could start with the Fiona Stanley Hospital, who are very compassionate and want to do better things for Aboriginal people. It's also built on the most important birthing site in the metro area for Noongar people, so if we do move the obstetric hospital down there, they should set up a fantastic Aboriginal birthing service there. So there are lots of things that could be done, and of course, as soon as you show that it is more cost effective and that the dollars will be produced, as these randomised trials have shown, how exciting is this? But, you know, I have a lot of problems with people not taking notice of evidence and data. So I know I'm naive, but, you know, hope springs eternal in the human breast anyway.
It has to, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Fiona, it's been really interesting, fascinating even talking to you about this book. Congratulations
to you
and Shawana and Sandra on producing it. I've actually read it and I just got into it. I thought, is this a dry academic tome? Is this written for certain types of health professionals?
The publishers told me to stop being so scientific, so I had to be more chatty. So you're seeing me being chatty.
Well, I think you've been very chatty with me this morning. Congratulations, as I say, to you on the book, and I'm sure it's going to get a wide readership. Thanks for meeting me.
Thank you very much, Michael.